The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum of Accelerated Government Strategies, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Women of Washington is a series of weekly radio interviews with Washington, D.C.'s most ambitious and influential female executives, role models for the next generation of Washington leaders. Aileen and Gigi interview the most accomplished women in Washington who share their life lessons and secrets to success.
I'm Aileen Black.
And I'm Gigi Shum.
Today in the studio, we have Elizabeth Shea, founder, president, and CEO of Speaker Box Communications, a firm that she co-founded in 1997. In her second decade since founding her own firm, Elizabeth's passion for technology, public relations, have grown stronger and more finely tuned with the arrival of new communication strategies.
Thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to it.
Elizabeth, I read that you grew up in Vermont, and virtually all of the very successful women that Aileen and I have a chance to interview tell us that they had a big influence in their life growing up. So who or what were your biggest influences?
You know, it's so funny. I heard an interview on one of your shows where you talked about a lot of the guests on the show are from small towns. And so, yes, I grew up in a very small town in Vermont and then proceeded to move to another very small town in Oregon before I moved to California to go to a small school, college, and university. So I would say that just the camaraderie and the community that was created in those particular environments helped me, I believe, feel like I could help have an impact. And that really drove me.
And so what made you decide that you wanted to go to school in California? It was certainly a long way from where you spent your early years in Vermont, not as far from Oregon.
Well, Santa Clara University is a wonderful school, and I'd like to say that it was because it was sunny, but the reality is it was a liberal arts community, basically, and an education, and it was right in the heart of Silicon Valley. And I was one of those girls, quote unquote, in school who studied computers at an early age, back when there were cassette tapes and such, and I wanted to follow the technology.
So you started out in Silicon Valley, liked technology. So did you start in technology after your first job? Was that your first job?
Actually, yes. My first job was Apple. It was Apple Computer back then. Now we're branded as Apple. And I worked in channel marketing. And so ironically, one of the first channels that I supported was the government vertical. And there was a company here that supported that marketplace. And I worked very closely with it. And that's what got me to DC eventually.
So tell me, that was, 20 plus years ago, and you can't help but pick up a trade rag right now or a newspaper that talks about the lack of diversity in the tech companies, in particular in Silicon Valley. What was it like back then to be a young woman that started in a high tech firm?
You know, interestingly enough, that's one of the reasons I was attracted to Apple, because it had a nice balance of genders and diversity, not like a lot of the other companies that I might have gone to work for in HP or some of the bigger firms. So it was really very welcoming. And I think I had a lot of women mentors and bosses there that helped me to feel comfortable in that environment. And there was a real empowerment. We had a CFO that was a woman at the time, for example. I mean, that was unheard of, particularly in any Fortune 500 company. So that was exciting for me.
So you mentioned that you had women who were mentors there. Was there anybody in particular that had a big impact on what was to become your career?
Actually, yes. I always have to go back to a woman, Tracy Weatherby, who was one of my bosses and partners at Apple. And she subsequently moved to a couple other startup companies. And as she moved, I moved. I followed her. And she is still a contact of mine today, a friend, a mentor. She really believed in me. And she also pretty much helped me get the entrepreneurial bug since we went to work for a very small company.
So what were some of the things that she told you early on that were helpful pieces of advice that maybe you still look back on now and think about?
Because she was very much a kind of female evangelist, if you will, I think her ability to say in what was at that point still, it was a male-dominated field, you know, follow your dreams, figure out what it is that you like and enjoy and go after that. At one point, I had always wanted to teach. And she said, why don't you just become a trainer for a while? Train on this on the products. And so she really helped me to figure out and fine-tune what it is that I wanted to do. And that evolved into my passion for PR.
You're really lucky in that you were able to find a female mentor. So many of the women that we have on this show who have had wonderfully successful careers, when we ask them about mentorship, we'll say, well, you know, there weren't many women around, and so, but I had some great men mentors. What was your experience? I mean, other than Tracy, were there a lot of other women around? I mean, both Aileen and I grew up in tech, and you know, we talk all the time about we never had to wait for the bathroom when we were
exactly.
at a conference because the women's bathroom, the line, there were no lines. Now, some of that's changing, but still the statistics are not really good for the number of minorities or women in high tech. So, you know, what you mentioned Apple, but how about some of the other places? Did you find that diversity? Were you able to have a lot of women mentors?
I actually did have a few female mentors later on, but they weren't necessarily my direct supervisor or manager. So, and I have some wonderful, wonderful male mentors as well. I think it's a matter of trying to find what's really right in terms of similar values and goals and who's willing to take the time. I think there are times when I first moved out here that I felt like I was one out of, 10% of the workforce and within the technology community here, particularly in DC. That was a big culture shift for me. So for me to be able to have a couple of people, even if there's a man to take me under their wing and say, hey, I see something in you. I see a passion that might enable you to start your own business or be more successful in tech. That was really encouraging to me.
Today in the studio, we have Elizabeth Shea, CEO of Speakerbox Communications. Elizabeth, I got to tell you something that I really want to talk to you about. You, after Apple, you started working for some very innovative startups there in Silicon Valley. Tell us about that.
Well, I looked at myself as going backwards in the food chain. If you think about some people who might want to work in a startup and then have that grow into a company that's, you know, post-IPO Fortune 500. I started out at a big company and went to smaller and smaller firms. And I think that's where I really enjoyed being able to have my hands in a lot of different parts of the business. And so the company after Apple was a company called Supermac, and they were a digital display compression company, and people weren't talking about that. They went public, and I learned a lot from that. And then the next company I went to work for was a pen-based computer, 25 years ahead of its time, and before the iPhones we have now. And that one went out of business. The venture capitalists closed the door. They had very, very deep pocket competitors. So I learned a lot from both of those experiences. And then that's when I moved to the East Coast after my experience at Momenta, and was able to work at an integrator that resold Apple systems. And so there was a lot of synergies there for me to get some experience in the channel.
So let's take a step back there. So you said something that is near dear to my heart. When working with startups, there's some really very big, strong lessons learned as you're looking at the startup and working with it. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience and what lessons learned you had along the way with choosing and working with a startup?
Wow, we've been working with startups for quite some time now, going into our 18th, 19th year of business. And I think the whole process of becoming a startup and starting a company, developing a technology has changed pretty significantly. And it's a lot easier to create a startup today. There isn't quite the capital requirements. You're able to secure financing to a greater extent, particularly with all the investment capital out there. So it's been an interesting evolution. I think sometimes the entrepreneurs become younger because they're more risk tolerant, if you will. But there are a lot of serial entrepreneurs, particularly in this community, that I think have really made a mark for themselves. And it's been interesting to watch that evolution. I think I applaud anyone who's willing to put their life on the line and start a business, whether it's a technology business or a services business, and really make a go for it.
So there's a lot of big companies right now that are having to rethink about their workforce and resizing. A lot of people are looking for opportunity, and there's a lot of startups in this area right now. So what's your thought about working for a small startup versus a large company?
Well, I personally enjoy working with, I am a small company, you know, we're a 20 person firm. So I consider ourselves boutique, but a lot of the startups are going to be just that more nimble, but they also need the kind of mentoring that I hope we can give them to be successful. A lot of those companies want to sell into the larger firms, but I'll tell you, there are a lot of companies in this region that that I think are going to struggle, and a lot of the larger firms that haven't been as nimble as they need to be. And we're really watching that, because that's part of the reason why they're starting to dip down into this entrepreneurial community to find out how they can either find the talent they need or the services or the products they need. So it's going to be an interesting evolution of the next few years. There are a couple of groups that I'm involved in, and one of them is a group called Tandem NSI, and they really cater to what's considered the non-traditional performers. Some of the bigger guys are just not going to be as successful in being nimble to the requirements of the government landscape and what we need for national security purposes, for example. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens over the next few years, and I think it's going to happen very quickly and in due form.
Today we're speaking with Elizabeth Shea, CEO of Speakerbox Communications. Coming up, we'll ask Elizabeth about founding her own PR firm. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, we're talking with Elizabeth Shea, CEO of Speakerbox Communications.
So, Elizabeth, in 1990, you decided to pack it up, leave Silicon Valley, and come to D.C. So why did you, of all the places you could have chosen, why did you choose D.C.?
Oh, wow. I love D.C. Since I originally grew up in Vermont, it was one of those places that I thought I'd love to spend some time there. You know, I'd visited as a child. It was either Boston or D.C., and at the time, D.C. was really calling, and it was a recession-proof slightly environment compared to what was happening in California at the time. So it made a lot of sense for me to pack up. And I'll tell you, I had a lot of friends here because I knew people in the community. And that was really important to me, to feel like I was not just abandoning my home, my family. I was going somewhere where I felt like I'd be welcome.
So how did you find the culture when, you know, you had been in Silicon Valley? You had, I guess, before that lived in Portland, then Silicon Valley. How did you find the culture of D.C. compared to the small towns and the small college that you had lived in?
Oh, it was very, very different. Very different. And I'll tell you, there were a couple differences that I recall. One was that it was so, the political climate here was so different. And in Silicon Valley, that wasn't quite on the top of everybody's minds. Whereas in D.C., that's all anyone talked about. And just a couple little anecdotes that I always found sort of strange, but people cared where I went to school. Most women never heard of Santa Clara, which was a little bit insulting, but then I would just point to Dee Dee Myers, since she was a grad from that school. And there were just a lot of very cliquey types of organizations, and there were not a lot of people that actually talked about technology. And so at first I thought, I'm miserable. I'm out of here in a year. And surprisingly, that was right around the time when new technology started to emerge and the venture capital market opened up. And so you started to see some companies. And before I left to go back, I said, you know, I'm going to give this a go. And one of the reasons was, and we haven't talked about how I started the company yet, but my PR firm, there were no other agencies that were talking about doing this kind of work that focused on technology. And I thought, well, there's an opportunity here. So why not start something? And there's a reason why so many other agencies started around that same time period.
Now, speaking of technology in D.C., you bring up a good point in that I think there's a lot of tech here. But in this particular administration with the government, they're still looking to Silicon Valley to bring in some heavy hitters from California. What's your view on that? Do you think that influx from Silicon Valley is a good thing into the government? Or you think that maybe there's, you know, people right here in the D.C. area that could bring as much to it?
I absolutely think that there's so much available in our backyard that that it's almost disappointing to see some of the agencies look to Silicon Valley. I think if you look at the different marketplaces, they're different, and Silicon Valley is really well known for some of the consumer applications. It's well known for some of the B2B pieces, but for the business of government, understanding the unique requirements of government, there are so many people here in our backyard. And yes, there have been a lot of technology companies here, but they tended to be more on the systems integration side, where they're developing their own rather than utilizing some of the products that are available today. So it's encouraging to see that that's changing. But recently, just a few months ago, DARPA and a couple other organization agencies went to Silicon Valley, and there's a lot of fanfare about that. Well, you know, it's disappointing to see, why aren't you looking here? There's so much with cybersecurity and with telecommunications and wireless and Internet of Things that's right here. you know, that's, I would like to see more of that and attention turned to those folks that can make it happen and actually have a relationship.
There's some great areas besides Silicon Valley where there's tons of startups. New York City, there's around here, the Boston area, Atlanta. You know, there's just so much activity across the board. You know, it's a high-class problem. I guess they could choose other locations. But I want to change this a minute. You brought up when you first came here, you started talking about, I think you started working for a systems integrator, but in 1997, you did a pretty bold move. You decided to leave it all and start your own firm. Specializing in public relations. Can you tell us why you made this bold decision?
You know, I'd love to say that it was very calculated. I know that my whole life I've wanted to have my own business. I wasn't quite sure what that would be. But it was more the situation where I was working for an integrator that resold some very name brand vendors and partners. And my boss asked me to find a firm. I need you to go out and find a PR firm that specializes in tech. And when the person that came in to meet with us was talking about trying to get us into modern maturity and not into GCN, I knew we had a problem. And that was the one tech company in town. So it realized if there is a gap, then that was something I wanted to try to fill. And so as many entrepreneurs will do, they will go to their first employer, to their employers, their first client. And that's what that's what Lee Raisler decided to do, who was my boss. And then the next person that came to us was a dear friend, Craig Abod, who was also starting a company. And I had people that already believed in me. And it was one of those situations where it just grew from there. You know, it was a risk. I kind of compare it to skydiving, where I was able to skydive once and I got to the bottom. I thought, that was crazy. But it was so exhilarating. They look back on it with fond memories. This is kind of the same when you start your business. You don't really think about it. You just jump out of the plane and then you get to the bottom and you think, wow, I'm kind of glad I got here safely, you know? So I feel like now after 18 years, we're here safely. It's just a matter of us figuring out now, you know, what's around the next corner.
So 1997 was a tough time to be starting a business, but in 2016 is a tough time to be starting a business now too, especially with the landscape changing with the Internet of Things and cloud computing. What do you think about starting a firm today?
I think that there's never a good time to start a company. There are so many firms that were started in the middle of a recession. There are some great success stories there. There are companies that were started at a bust only to see themselves go down. So I believe that the time to start a company is when you're passionate enough to do it and you feel like you have the resources to make it happen and you're ready to take that chance. You know, one of our clients started his company in 2009, and I thought he was crazy. He was taken over for another company that was basically had gone down to zero, took it over, and now he's a $35 million company today. And it's those kinds of success stories, I think, that will happen only if you're really passionate about what you want to do. So if you feel like you have the ability and the risk-taking and the passion for it, there's never a bad time.
You've made it through multiple recessions, great times and not great times. What characteristic, if you had to point to one to say, this is why I think we've made it, what do you attribute that to?
Well, first, a great team that actually believes in sticking with you through thick or thin. But it really, I believe, at the core comes down to, for anyone else out there that thinks they might have to go through this, you just have to believe you're not going to fail because there's no other option. What is your other option? Go and take a position somewhere doing something you may not enjoy. You're letting down people that work for you. People have livelihoods that rely on you. And that's very powerful when it comes to getting up every morning and thinking, what am I going to do today?
Today in the studio, we have Elizabeth Shea, CEO of Speakerbox Communications. Elizabeth, you know, how has the world of public relations and the influence changed over the years since you've started your business?
Oh, wow. I think it's one of the most evolving disciplines, if you will, within the professional services communities that I've seen, as opposed to like accounting or legal or even maybe banking. I think, you know, when we started, we literally had a fax machine and it was how many fax machines you had. And I know that people tell these stories. And I'm going to be dating myself, but it was really very, very different. And it was more about, actually, I'll give you a really good example. There were times when we would hire and be looking to hire people that had a sales background, because what you really needed to do was call and browbeat the reporters to try to write about you. And it was selling. It was influencing with a very push mentality. And now it's more about how do you bring the reporters to you because we have a story to tell, you know, for our clients, on behalf of our clients. Now it's social media, following and engaging from that standpoint, much more relationship building. And now we need to hire people that are writers and content developers and not salespeople because they're just not the right fit. So we'll find and hire these writers, content people, people that would rather actually curl up in a beanbag chair and write than to get on the phone and smile and dial. So that's one example of how things have changed. And then there's of course all of the people that are former reporters that are now bloggers and making money and monetizing from that standpoint. The landscape changed as to who really is influential and who's going to work on behalf of our clients. And it's also really interesting to see how many people can become their own journalist, their own citizen journalist. And we do that for our clients. In fact, a lot of our clients have become well-respected bloggers, well-respected thought leaders. So it just means a different level of engagement, and it means much more of a one-to-one rather than a one-to-many type of mentality.
Social media has really changed things. I mean, now everybody's a restaurant critic, right?
Yes.
You can get on Yelp and learn about every restaurant. But let's talk about the other side of the coin changing. You know, with cloud computing and the Internet of Things, your customers are grappling with the sea change of who they are, how they monetize. Has that created some new challenges for you?
Actually, it has. I'm glad you bring that up because I think the biggest struggle we have trying to represent some of these clients is trying to help educate on how the marketplace has changed. It's not about doing a press conference anymore. It's about engaging with a reporter who wants to be, a successful vehicle to his or her readership and what they want to hear and what they want to cover. So, for example, if we end up talking to a company and all they want to do is talk about products, then that's just not going to fly. We're not going to be able to talk about a security product. We need to talk about how it actually affects, you know, agency cyber defense systems. And that's a really big distinction because you're never going to find any reporter worth his salt talking about products. They're going to be talking about themes and how it's going to benefit the constituents, how it's going to benefit the agencies and their ability to operate against their mission.
Today, we're talking with Elizabeth Shea, CEO of Speakerbox Communications. Coming up, we'll ask Elizabeth about some recent awards Speakerbox has won. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Tracy McRae. Human organ transplantation has come a long way since it was first used over 50 years ago. Despite the process, there is still a severe shortage of organs.
One donor can help maybe 50 or 60 patients by giving organs, by giving tissue, cornea, and so their effect is profound.
Dr. Brooks Edwards, Director of Transplantation and Clinical Regeneration at Mayo Clinic, says over 100,000 people every day in the U.S. are awaiting organ transplants.
But our hope is that over the years, we won't have to be waiting for donors and a tragic death to have a successful transplant.
Techniques like living donors are possible. Dr. Edwards explains a surgeon can remove one kidney or half a donor's liver, and most of that liver can regenerate in 6 weeks. To learn more about organ donation, visit www.donatelife.net. For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org.
FederalNewsRadio.com, your one-stop shop for all things federal. Listen daily to interviews with federal managers and government contractors. Read Mike Causey's daily federal report, or just stop by for an update on the latest news affecting the federal community. FederalNewsRadio.com, your source for federal news now.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we're talking with Elizabeth Shea, CEO, Speakerbox Communications.
So, Elizabeth, recently I saw a picture of you on the Jumbotron in Times Square ringing the closing bell on Wall Street. So that must have been just thrilling.
It was very thrilling. We actually were able to be a part of the Deloitte Fast 500 technology, basically the fastest 500 technology companies, to receive that award or that accolade in the last year. And one of the things that the D.C. office enabled us to do is to take all of the winners in this region to New York and basically demonstrate these are fast-growing, emerging technology companies. again, another demonstration of that non-traditional performer. And for them to have their eyes and light up and be kind of visualized potentially ringing the bell for themselves one day was really thrilling. That was a lot of fun.
You've won some other awards recently, too.
Actually, yes, we've had a nice run the past few years. I think one of the reasons that that we like to at least accept nominations or submit for some of these things is that we like to practice what we preach. We believe that award recognition demonstrates a third-party validation, and that's what we encourage our clients to do. And sometimes there's some modesty there, but it's really, really important. So, yes, I know we've had a couple of our executives win some awards as well, which I think are it's really important to make sure that there's a face beyond the CEO. So we've won recently the Smart CEO Brava Award. Lisa Throckmorton won that. As a company, we won 50 on Fire with DC Inno. That was pretty exciting because that was a big kind of, a big momentum builder, and they really tried to get people excited about that. And we also actually recently went to New York to accept, we did not know that we were going to win, but it felt very Oscar-like, everyone's sitting in the audience and then they call up the person who won, and we won a Women in Business Award there too. So I was able to bring a few members from my team, and that was really rewarding for all of us to be there.
So you alluded to this, but the question I was going to ask as a follow-up is, you always hear that cliche about the cobbler's children having no shoes. And so does a PR firm, do you have to really focus on doing some PR for yourself? I mean, you spend all day doing it for
yes,
your clients. So.
Exactly. I do believe that it's important to demonstrate that things can work, because I can then also talk about it from a firsthand perspective. I literally just came from a meeting prior to this where I was talking to a services company, cybersecurity company, who wants to rebrand. And I said, well, this is what we went through 3 years ago. This is why I think you have to stick to your knitting. This is why I think you have to focus on themes and not products. And because we lived it. This is why I think social media is important. I was the last one in my company to get on Facebook. I'll tell you right that. And one of my employees came to me and said, Elizabeth, seriously, okay, you know what? You're right. We're encouraging our clients to do this and the CEOs to be there. And it's not just Facebook, but LinkedIn, and making sure that your website property matches what you do, making sure the messaging is correct, making sure you blog. It is unbelievable how many companies still don't have a blog. It still amazes me, especially in technology. So I do believe it's important to practice what you preach and put that into motion, even though it requires resources of our own team to do so.
So along those lines of social media and communications, the world of marketing and media and communications and PR, in the last few years, it seems to be kind of merging together. So at this point, I think it's difficult to tell what is a true media or news outlet and what's a marketing firm. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that, and not only on that, but how it's impacted PR and the way that you do PR around that.
That's a very interesting question. We were just talking about that last night when I was at an event with several of my colleagues who also run agencies. And for some folks, it's going to be just too exhausting to try to navigate the new waters of communications. But the reality is that's what's happening. There's a convergence. People are trying to take and claim different parts of the communications and marketing spectrum. And ironically, I made an analogy the other day that it's almost like what we see in cybersecurity. I mean, think about how many different types of products and endpoints and ways to approach cybersecurity there are. It's confusing. It's cluttered. And there's going to be a shakeout and there's going to be an evolution. And so the people that really believe, I personally believe, the people that will believe that there is an end game, it's all going to matter. What's going to matter is what's going to be relevant and get through to the final audience. And as far as the landscape changing and how it affects what we do, it just means we have to be that much more nimble and understanding who's really an influencer. There are marketing firms that are very influential, and we need to respect that, even if they might be a competitor. There are reporters who are trying to set out on with a new blog and are really very respectable and have some influence, but you won't know until they really get themselves out there and see what they're able to do with it. And I think with a lot of the citizen journalism, there's still the question about monetization, and that's going to drive a lot. So it's being a startup blogger is the same thing as starting a business, I mean, to a certain extent.
Speaking and shifting gears a little bit, it's speaking about the big show and shifting gears and getting a little bit confused on the messaging. Let's talk about the business of politics, which is what we are about around this Beltway. And the spin in the PR that is going to be happening across the country with the presidential election. How do you think the big spin will affect this election with all the change in multi and social media? And, you know, people get their information so many different ways, and it's confusing.
Exactly. Exactly. And I do think, partly to Gigi's point earlier, there was a sense of who's really a marketing firm, who's a citizen journalism, where does the influence come from? I think that in every single election we've seen, there has been a sea change. And I think we're going to continue to see that today. I think some will embrace it. Everyone gets their information differently. There was so much discussion about the millennials. I mean, sometimes I want to say, let's not forget about me either. But people will get information in different ways. And I don't know that it's even so much about the age and the demographics, but more about how people are most comfortable getting their information. And it's very disparate, but you have to speak to all those channels. And that's going to continue to be the challenge in any kind of communication or marketing initiative or program, that you have to be able to speak on multiple levels and to multiple channels. And that's just the new reality. There's no going back. So I think it's something for all of us to consider. And I'm going to be really curious to see how it evolves. There's so much focus on the politicians getting their message across and how they get their message across and through what vehicles. Will be curious to see what the statistics end up showing after this election.
Today, we're talking with Elizabeth Shea, CEO of Speakerbox Communications. Coming up, we'll ask Elizabeth about networking and some of her hobbies and passions. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, we're talking with Elizabeth Shea, CEO of Speakerbox Communications.
So, Elizabeth, I would assume as a PR professional, it's really important to be a good networker. And you seem to be a fantastic networker. I've read that you work with several organizations, and a couple of them you've mentioned, Founder Corps, EODC.
Mm-hmm.
You serve on the boards of Mindshare and Mission Link and TMA. So tell us a little bit about some of these organizations. Are they an opportunity for you to give back, or do they help you build your company, or is it a little bit of both?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. And, you know, I know many PR people who are not necessarily networkers, but I do believe that as a PR professional, you need to be a connector. And so to be a connector, it helps to know the ecosystem around, you know, the things that the things you're passionate about. So each one of those organizations has a little different appeal to me. So a Mindshare or a Mission Link, in my mind, those are about giving back, but it's also good branding for our firm, for Speakerbox. We give of our time there. And those are two organizations that are for entrepreneurs in the business-to-business in the Mindshare side and business-to-government in the Mission Link side that are really looking as a first-time CEO to be successful, and they need the right kind of ecosystem around them. So I really enjoy giving back to those folks in terms of advice or counsel on how they might select some of their partners. A group like Founder Corps, that's all about the entrepreneurial community in any sense. And how do you give back through mentoring programs? We do a lot of work there, teach at a lot of the universities, most of the members there. It's a small organization, 30 people. But again, it's something that we really believe is successful in helping entrepreneurs to grow. EODC is a group of entrepreneurs that are all of a certain size. And so we share similar values, similar challenges in growing our businesses. And that's a little different spin. And then we've also been involved in, me personally, and also much of my team, since we have a fair amount of females on our staff, the Women in Technology organization, which is a really wonderful opportunity, a wonderful organization that is focused on helping empower women in this particular workforce locally. There are others that are more charitable in nature, and then others that are more about, you know, name recognition, if you will. So TMA is an organization we founded 10 years ago. Speakerbox actually did. And it's a group of chief marketing officers who are working in emerging firms, whether it's business to government or business to business. And they want to help develop their own company and have a peer organization. So it's a peer organization. It's a labor of love for us, but we're also able to learn from CMOs and what kind of challenges they face. So that's been a really, really neat organization to see grow.
So a theme that I'm hearing throughout a lot of these organizations is entrepreneurship. And so obviously, I'm assuming that one of the reasons that you're so passionate about entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship is because you started your own firm. But does it go beyond that? I mean, is it because you wish that you had somebody, an organization like that when you were starting out? Or where does that come from?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know I did co-found the business with a partner, and we really struggled. It was hard, especially as two women. You know, people didn't take us seriously, and you know, sorry to play the female card, but that was really tough. Are we starting a business? So you want a lifestyle business? Are you going to start a family? It's unbelievable. The banks wouldn't talk to us. All kinds of things happened, and it was really frustrating. And I don't want to, you know, get on my soapbox, but I see particularly a lot of young people not being taken seriously when they have amazing ideas to support. I see a lot of women not necessarily being taken seriously. And it's nice to have a peer group of other folks to know you're not alone. You know, EODC only 10 years ago had maybe 2-3% women in the organization, particularly in this chapter. You know, now we're, I think, one of the largest female representation with 20%. So it is about giving back, and I want to be able to support that. And I think there's not enough of that going on from people who really know how to make it happen.
So, Elizabeth, let me flip that on you a little bit. Have you had an opportunity to mentor somebody starting out there in a company, men or women?
Absolutely. And in fact, I have a couple people right now that I'm talking to who one person wants to start a photography business. Another wants to start a consulting business. And I got really involved in women and technology in particular from that capacity, since there were so many people that would just say, I don't understand. When do I hire that first person? You know, the fear, the, you know, when is that time? When is the time right to take that leap of faith? The one thing that I think has been really challenging for people that want to start their own business, it's one thing to hang a shingle. It's another thing to build a sustainable business that isn't just you. And so how do you figure out what the right mechanics are in terms of how do you fund it? How do you capitalize on it? What kind of business do you want to become? So there are typically 2-3, maybe 4 people in my life that I would potentially be a part of mentoring. The EODC group actually has a really nice accelerator program, which are companies that are less than $1 million. There are 2 women there that I'm mentoring today. I spend a day a month with them. That's a lot. That's a time commitment. But they need to know, how is it that I can get to where I can be that level where you've been able, what you've been able to accomplish.
So you sounded like you may have had some challenges early on. I know you mentioned you had a partner, mm-hmm. and now you're single,
yes,
ownership of the company. So tell us about some of those challenges that you had and advice you would give to some of these people you're being the mentor for.
Well, it's funny. I was talking to another woman who has a PR firm the other day, and we were talking about how she was asking me the question. She said, I never took a partner in the beginning. That must have been so nice. And I said, it was. It was actually great. We were lucky. We were very fortunate. I learned a lot. My partner and I actually were very, very good together in terms of supporting each other and helping to be that sounding board. And we were very different, which made it very appealing. And I think that was probably how we were able to make it happen at that point, particularly because there are meetings we walked out of when we were just sort of, you know, give a pat on the head and you walk out the door, and we would just say, you know, forget that. Like, we're gonna shrug it off. We could talk about it with each other. Now I see it's a lot easier for women to get some of that support. And whether it's men or women to get that support when they're starting their business, it's just a matter of being able to have the confidence to say, this is going to happen and we're going to be successful. So, yes, I think the harder part was having someone that could help me and my business partner go through the purchase of her shares and have an understanding of it and realize this wasn't a catfight. I mean, that was probably the biggest challenge, to be perfectly candid. It was, no, we're perfectly amicably separating, and we're pursuing different paths, and we're in support of each other. But our competition used that against us like there was nobody's business. So there are interesting challenges that I hadn't anticipated from that standpoint.
So let's shift gears a little bit here. You've talked about the organizations that you work with and all the philanthropic work. How about hobbies? What do you like to do when you're not working?
First of all, what do you mean by not working?
Yeah, good point. Good point.
Well, I like to golf. It was somewhat hampered by the hip replacement I had to get a couple of years ago. Maybe this is too much information, but I'm looking forward to getting back involved in that again. There's some great business reasons to do so and some great personal reasons to do so. I strive to take a week vacation every year, a week vacation every quarter to really recharge. And I love playing with my dog. I'm a big, I've been a rescue dog person before, so it's a passion of mine to help just get back to the four-legged critters.
A lot of the women that we interview say that their hobbies or what they do in their spare time does recharge them. And so do you find that true for yourself as well?
Absolutely. I think you say your spare time, and I mean that seriously, that when you're a business owner, you both know this, you rarely are not working, even if you're involving your family and activities or things like that. You're still always working. You're always thinking. And I actually get fueled by that. So we just got back from a retreat of several other business women owners and myself, and we went to Cancun, and it was a thinking time, but it was a recharge for me. So I don't mean to imply that I don't have balance. I actually think I have a lot of balance because I can take the time to do what I want when I need to.
Today we're talking with Elizabeth Shea, CEO of Speakerbox Communications. So Elizabeth, I've loved your stories and everything you've talked about today, but if you were to go back to yourself to be a mentor and give her some advice about how to achieve the success you've had in today's world or even, you know, find that other level of success, what would you tell her?
Well, I think one thing I did not mention as part of my story was when I first moved out here, I only worked within the systems integrator for about a year, and then I went on my own as an independent contractor. And I was so nervous about that I ended up going and taking a job. And I said, well, let me just go back and really learn how to do this right. And so the answer then would be more that I wish I would have been more of a risk taker and seen that through that first time, because it took me a couple of years to figure that out. And I think part of the reason that I was challenged in that regard is because I didn't have quite the network that I needed to be successful that first time around. I wasn't charging enough. I wasn't valuing my services enough. And so I was able to learn, again, thanks to the next position that I took, on how to make that more successful. But if I had built my network up sooner, that would have been, I think, a much more solid way of approaching the future for me.
Today, our guest has been Elizabeth Shea, CEO of Speakerbox Communications. Aileen and I are founders of Accelerated Government Strategies. You can learn more about AGS and the work we can do to help accelerate your business plans for a public sector at excelgovstrat.com. I'm Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Women of Washington on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.